Welcome to Reading, Writing, Rolling, Imagination and Fiction in the Age of Harry Potter. This is episode 43, The Wizard and the Hopping Plot, another of our mini-episodes with bonus content. Today we'll be talking with Travis Prinzi about another of J.K. Rowling's fantasy fairy tales. For joining us for Reading, Writing, Rolling. I am your host, Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, and co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds, too. My co-host today is Emily Strand, Instructor of Comparative Religions at Mount Carmel College of Nursing and author of several Harry Potter essays. Emily, I'm so excited for our conversation today.
I am so excited as well. I've been dying to talk about the Ichabod. Oh, wait, no, that's not what we're talking about.
Different fairy tale.
Oh,
I know.
That one. Okay, we'll talk about this one first, and then at some point we'll talk about the Ichabod.
Yeah, the Ichabod is so interesting, and it seems kind of long. There's a lot of chapters here coming out and through
I'm
July.
Ready. I'll take it.
Oh, me too. Joining us today in our conversation about an earlier fairy tale written by J.K. Rowling is Travis Prinzi, author of Harry Potter and the Imagination and editor of numerous anthologies, including Hogshead Conversations, Harry Potter for Nerds, and of course, he is the co-editor with me on Harry Potter for Nerds, too. Thanks so much, Travis, for being on the show today.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to be here. Although I'm going to be a bit of a disappointment if you decide to talk about the Ichabod, because I'm only 3.5 chapters in. I'm behind. So, I got to catch up.
Well, by the time the show comes out, there will be, maybe 25 chapters. So we're only on chapter 10.
Where did you keep going? Yeah.
So it's easy to get out of date when it's coming out every day like that.
Yes, it is.
Things change. Things change in that world.
Yeah, that's true. I'm getting a strong feeling of dread. I'm quite worried at this point.
Like from the last line of every chapter? Is that what you mean?
Yeah. Oh, wow. The foreboding. Well, yeah, we are talking today about a much shorter story, the first story in Beetle the Bard's collection of tales. This story is The Wizard and the Hopping Pot, a deceptively simple and straightforward narrative of a young and selfish wizard who learns empathy and service to others. But as we read not only the story, but also Albus Dumbledore's gloss on it, we can see there are depths to be plumbed here. It is sort of deceptively simple. There's a lot of richness to the story. Let's start our analysis with some of the tale's structure and what we think is perhaps its core theme. So what are some of the key fairy tale elements in this story, do you all think? And what moral are they pointing to?
So the moral of the story ends up being an interesting thing that kind of Dumbledore goes back and forth about. You've got the obvious, be kind to everybody no matter what moral. And then you've got the deeper political commentary going on. With a story like this, as we were prepping for the show, we talked about it, that you kind of pass by it once or twice, and it's kind of a simple, straightforward story, and you think, there's the tale of, being nice to people, even if they're mean to you, and that's a good thing to teach children. And then you read it again in a different political context, years after the first time we read it, and we're sitting in a very different, life context now, and it just strikes you differently. And that's what makes fairy tales so interesting, is that they're not as simple as these cute little moral stories about being kind to people. They often, they have more impact depending on the scenario that you're in. And so this fairy tale really works in a powerful way in that way, and that it's striking me in a much different way than I did when I first read it.
Yeah, I had that experience too, Travis, that, you know, when I first read it, I thought, well, of course, you know, I sort of think as the parent would teach the child, you can kind of see this is about, you know, having empathy for other people's suffering and trying to help people out. But Dumbledore emphasizes the, as you mentioned, the political context of it that makes doing that really perhaps, you know, even a subversive act. And I love how he says, like at the beginning of his editorial commentary, he says, a simple and heartwarming fable, one might think, in which case one would reveal oneself to be an innocent nincompoop. Right. So he's sort of challenging us, like, this tale is not just this very simple story that you think you've gotten, you've already figured it out, and you think you're already on the right side of it. He's trying to point you to some of the complexities of the tale, and particularly, you know, the wizard muggle divide that it is pointing out. And although that would seem like something that would not be relevant to us right now, of course, it does have its corollaries in any us versus them, other and self conflict, which, of course, we are seeing quite a lot of right now.
And that's really interesting, that's kind of you, the first response you two that struck you two about the story. Because to be honest, when you said what fairy tale elements and what kind of what's the first thing you think when you think of the story, is I thought about the trope of the kind person that dies and the one who replaces them is not as kind and who receives an inheritance that has sort of both a blessing in it, but then also a responsibility, and doesn't realize that those two go together, you know? And so that's kind of, and I say like that's a trope, but I'm not sure I'm thinking of like what other stories use that trope, but it's familiar. There's something familiar about it when you're mm-hmm. reading it, to think about, oh, okay, here comes number two, and he's not going to be nearly as much of he's going to have to come into his role as the new number one. You know, he's not going to have this automatically. He has to learn that these two, that this blessing and this responsibility are intertwined and can't be separated of the inheritance that he's given. So that's my first takeaway from this story.
Yeah, that is a common element. I'm trying to think of a fairy tale that fits that. I know they exist.
It's probably, it may be more the Bible that I'm thinking of.
I thought of Samuel and then Samuel's sons in the Old Testament, the turning over of, you know, rule to somebody else who is not so kind or good.
To be honest, I thought about the Ichabod as well, but I know we're not going to get into that yet.
Yes, she's playing out something similar there maybe. Although, so I also had that thought of generational change and that there is a generational inheritance that is being passed along. And you know what I thought of? It's just not very far away. I thought of the invisibility cloak. You have an enchanted object that has this moral component, and yet it could be used for a whole host of reasons. And the person who has it has to figure it out as they go along. And Harry is not like the young selfish wizard in the Wizard and the Hopping Pot story, but there is a way in which, you know, he has to kind of come to terms with this enchanted object or this, as you said, this kind of gift that he has inherited. And we could think of that even in terms of talents that have been inherited that have responsibilities that come with them.
Oh, talents, did you say? Because this story also very much struck me as maybe elusive with the story of the talents in the Gospel of Matthew, where the estate owner hands out these talents, which are these kind of monetary units, to his slaves, his servants. And, you know, he gives them, you know, five to one, two to another, one to another, according to their abilities. And the one with five goes and invests it and makes five more. And the one with two does the same thing with his two. And then the one buries his because he's afraid to lose it. He's afraid to do anything wrong with it. And so he is rejected by his master because he doesn't share his talents. He doesn't put his talents out in the world. And so there is something interesting in terms of a parallel. It's definitely not one-to-one because the story of the talents ends quite differently. But he does, that's what initially struck me about this story.
I think the story does have a bit of a parable feel to it. I also kind of thought in terms of parables on that. And Interestingly, the one that came to mind was the parable of the Good Samaritan, where somebody who maybe you would think would be on the opposite side of ends up being somebody who is helpful and who is the, you know, the generous and the merciful person who helps you in a time of need. And that's speaking to something in this muggle wizard divide, this us versus them.
Yeah, that's the one that crossed my mind too. And there's definitely a sort of a transcendent loving your enemies moral to this story that is what the Good Samaritan parable really is about. It's not so much, Jesus doesn't answer the question in that parable, who is my neighbor? He turns it around on the person asking the question and basically says, are you willing to think of anybody as your neighbor, even if they are your enemy in your mind? Which one acted the most neighborly? And it turns out to be somebody who that person would have thought of as an enemy. And so that parable and that moral seem to come together. And I wonder, the thing that strikes me a lot about this story, which makes it a bit complicated for me, is that I don't know that the son does the right thing, but I don't know that he learned his lesson. The last line is that he helped villagers lest the pot cast off its slipper and begin to hop once more. And so the pot was being this voice of all the pain in the world, but it's almost like he did this just to shut the thing up. Whereas the real lesson you want out of something like this is to be more willing to hear the pain in the world and to do something about it, not just to do something about it to shut them up. You know, just it's interesting wording.
But. Yeah, I had that same sense and the same slight disappointment with that you did, Travis, you know. And I think it's like one of those Kohlberg levels of moral development, that it's still doing something so you don't get punished. And instead of having that sense of a higher moral reason that you're doing something. And maybe that's because it's aimed, you know, at the child level. But I do think that the hopping pot sounds like somebody's conscience. There's this line where the wizard could not sleep or eat with the pot beside him, but the pot refused to leave and he could not silence it or force it to be still. So in a way it is his conscience, and he's just doing what he has to keep his conscience quiet. And maybe it's not reaching the highest levels of moral development there.
No, it's reminding me of A Christmas Carol by Dickens. You know, where although Scrooge obviously really does learn his lesson, but boy, he gets the fear of God placed in him in order to do so. But he is ultimately changed in the end. And maybe kind of that's what's missing in this story, is the assurance that this wizard would continue to understand his responsibility to his fellow humans, even without the threat of the dreaded pot. And I love how his father knew this would be a problem. Mm-hmm. Right. He hoped it wouldn't. He hoped it wouldn't, but he knew it would be a problem. And that reminded me of when Dumbledore gives Ron the Deluminator. Right. He's like, I really hope you wouldn't need this, but I'm going to go ahead and slip this to you right here, because I think this is going to be a problem in the future. And I'm going to give you an out right here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really am intrigued also by the political context. Like, it's the historical context part that I've gravitated toward here, which is that this is a story written in the 15th century, and Dumbledore specifically ties it into the witch craze, the witchcraft persecutions, which actually they ratchet up later, but nevertheless, we'll give them a little pass on that. There were witchcraft persecutions going on in the 1400s, but the idea here is that Beetle the Bard is writing this story about a wizard, you know, basically turning over his life and talents to help muggles in the village and to keep quiet about it, right? To make it seem like he's, you know, he's not working magic at a time when, you know, people who could do magic were very vulnerable to persecution, and that gives what he's doing this edge that actually puts him in a quite vulnerable position to be, you know, he seems like he's the powerful one, but when he is helping these muggles, he does make himself vulnerable, and that Beetle is actually saying yes, and that's what he should be doing.
Right, and that's where the loving your enemies thing comes in. I mean, we forget sometimes as we're reading the Wizarding World and hearing about all of their powers and the things that they can do to muggles, like memory modification and whatever else. we forget sometimes that we are siding with the group that is in hiding, because however much magic you've got, you know, Muggles come at you with atomic bombs and you're not going to have a chance. So we're always sort of in the position of what do you do from the position of being an oppressed group, which is a complicated imaginative space to be in, because most of the time the dynamic in the wizarding world is should we fight back at Muggles or not? You know, it's a very interesting kind of moral space to be in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think, was that a Fantastic Beasts reference there with the atop vision of the atomic bombs actually kind of leading wizards into this attitude of conflict? And so much of the introduction to Beetle the Bard's Tales, which is J.K. Rowling speaking, she actually points to Dumbledore's reflections on the tales actually being him trying to relearn or forgive himself for making mistakes that are pointed out in these stories. And you think about Dumbledore's own flirtation with magic is might. And that he's learning this tale as well, even as an older wizard.
Yeah, there's so many layers here. And that, like, Dumbledore, of course, his interpretation isn't a perfect interpretation. It's the interpretation of another man in his own setting at his own time. Just like we're sitting and reading these layers, you know, in the context of, you know, the death of George Floyd and the protests that are going on. And we're in our own context. There's so many layers of playing with these stories in each context.
And I think that's what made me think it was so parable-like, because it is a bit of a spare tale. It doesn't have a whole lot of detail in it, and that makes it more applicable to a variety of situations where you can read it in different ways. And of course, Dumbledore points out to us in his commentary that there have been other versions of this story. The one that we get, we're told, is Hermione's translation, I guess from ancient runes, of Beetle Bard's Tale. But he says that people actually, wizards burned the story. I mean, it was so subversive to suggest that a wizard ought to have this sort of relationship with the Muggles around that it became banned literature. And that this was particularly happening in a context in which wizards felt persecuted. And they developed a new version of the tale. Now, kids, of course, love all of the grody stuff with the cauldron being so aggressive. And so they keep it, but they make the cauldron, like, eat all the Muggles who are persecuting the wizards, which is a totally different story, you know? I love the idea that the tale is rewritten for different times and that Dumbledore himself is pointing out to us the flexibility of not just this story, but in fact, all kinds of stories.
The wizard and the insatiable Muggle eating cauldron.
Right.
Doesn't ring as well. It rings in a different way.
Right. That's right.
Yeah, no, you're right, Katie, though. It is kind of an empty vessel sort of story where you can pour into it a lot of different ideas and scenarios and kind of moral lessons into it. Kind of like a good, like a good hero's tale where you can kind of pour yourself into the role of the hero.
It can almost be called The Wizard and the Hopping Plot.
Very clever. And of course, then Dumbledore tells us about probably the more famous version of the story as it is rewritten by Beatrix Bloxam in the Toadstool Tales, which is a riff on the sanitation of fairy tales that J.K. Rowling likes to put out there. And that she says, you know, she doesn't like all of the kind of nasty stuff and the bad stuff in the tale. And she says that her intent is filling the pure minds of our little angels with healthy, happy thoughts, keeping their sweet slumber free of wicked dreams and protecting the precious flower of their innocence. And she totally finds this story of the Wizard and the Hopping Pot, as Beetle wrote it, to be unacceptable. And she has to rewrite it because it perhaps is a little too gritty for children in her estimation. So what do we think we're supposed to get from that?
Well, has anybody done the genealogical work to link this Beatrix Bloxam person directly to Dolores Umbridge?
Seems
because
similar.
Someone needs to do that.
Yeah, similar kind of idea, right? That we have to protect children from reality.
And that has always attracted me to Harry Potter. There's just something about the danger, not just the danger for the sake of danger of the wizarding world, because I honestly, I would have a problem with that. But the refusal to shelter young people from things that they really need to know about in order to prepare their response, from a young age, and to prepare the right response, not the selfish, self-preserving response, but to prepare the selfless response. And I feel like this fits right in with that thread throughout the Potter books.
Yeah. I mean, she's been doing this since Philosopher's Stone, where, Hermione's appalled at the idea that Dumbledore might have let Harry sort of have a shot at facing Voldemort first, and Harry goes, I think that Dumbledore knows what's going on around here, and he wanted me to have a shot at it, and that sounds horrible. Why would he let that happen? But it's what needed to happen, and it's what Harry needed in that moment.
And I think she's not naive that children have wicked dreams, and children are exposed to a lot of horrifying parts of reality, and there's no point really in sheltering them so much that they're naive, because it doesn't work anyway.
Yeah. It's like what Maurice Sendak said when he got criticized for Where the Wild Things Are. He said, children are dreaming these monsters anyway. That's not the problem. The problem is when they find no corollary for them in their life, no explanation, nothing that helps them get a handle on them. And that's why he wrote the stories that he wrote.
Yeah, very good. And I think also J.K. Rowling herself got attacked for that, right? That was one of the reasons that people used to ban her books, was that they were too dark for children, and children shouldn't be reading about these things that they're not mature enough to deal with yet. Just in our contemporary times, I'm thinking about this because I just was talking with my daughter about what was going on this weekend with the protests and the riots. It's about more than George Floyd's murder. It is about a whole host of structural inequalities that have continued and persisted to a point where people don't have an avenue to say anything about them except through protest.
Right, which includes this pandemic and the disproportionate effect this pandemic has on people of color.
Yes. Yes, that is a huge part of the context as well, that the pandemic is affecting different people in different ways. And this, an already marginalized, oppressed group of people more severely than others. And I thought about how important it is that we do have to talk to our children about what's going on. And you can talk about it in an age-appropriate way, but it doesn't help to keep them ignorant of the current events that are going on, even when they are complicated and even when they are filled with, the real grit and violence that actually does exist out there. Hard to talk about it, but I think important.
Right. You've rendered us thoughtful, Katie.
Okay.
No, it's just there's so much to say. It's almost, even for somebody like me, it kind of renders me silent because I just...
And, I wonder, too, if this is, the wizard with his pot, he'd like to just isolate himself from all of the pain and suffering that's going on around him. But he has to be confronted with it because of the pot. And this is the world knocking at his door saying, we need you. And that maybe this is something that children ought to be prepared for, too. We have a little song that the children sing in our church, although really we all sing it at our church, which is what can one little person do? It's one can help another one, and together we can get the job done. And it's a very simple theme, but I think it's, it's actually really important that the world needs you, and it doesn't matter if you're little or big. It doesn't matter if you're one person. That's what we're here for. And I think this story really gets at that. It's one of those profound and simple and yet extremely hard things to actually do.
I went around last night. I live in Columbus, Ohio, and our downtown was under a state of emergency last night. We had a 10 p.m. to 6 a.m. curfew, and hearing a lot of sirens, hearing a lot of, you know, even in our neighborhood, which is not that far from downtown. And I actually went around last night because it was a little chilly too. So I went around shutting my downstairs windows and closing all my drapes. And I'm doing it. I'm just kind of doing it like instinctively because I wanted to kind of settle down for the night. And, but I wanted all those windows and all those drapes closed. And I sat down on the couch after that and I felt guilty for doing it. You know, because I felt like my instinct was telling me to shut out the world. Like, I was just like, I can't take it anymore. Like, I had this pandemic thing. I thought I had this under control. I was washing my hands 50 times and now there's something else going on, you know, and it's just even bigger, you know, it feels even bigger and more grave. But yeah, I think that was that hopping pot, you know, hopping after me going, hey, listen, you can't, that's not the answer to this question, is to just, you know, run away or to sequester yourself or to hide. That's not the inheritance that you received, right?
Yeah. And, you know, I was reading some of the analysis of Wizard and the Hopping Pot that's out there, and there's not a lot, but there are some suggestions that people have felt as though the Hopping Pot is kind of like a bully and have suggested, you know, again, the wizard doesn't really change his attitude. He's just trying to not be bullied anymore by this hopping pot that won't leave him alone, is belching out slugs and is covered in warts and, you know, braying like a donkey and all of those things. And that the wizard has lost free will and the wizard is just following along and doing what needs to be done. And that that there's actually something that's really wrong with this part of the story. What do you all think of that? Should we be mad at the hopping pot?
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm a very anti-bully sort of person. I think that we all should be. I think that if you think about this a bit in terms maybe of the rightful place of laws or law enforcement, and that it can be done in a bullying sort of way, but it can also be done in a... We don't want to have only two options in society. Either your motives are completely pure, leading to good actions, or your motives are completely evil, leading to good actions. You might need to sort of put some guardrails in place to make people behave from time to time, or they're going to end up in jail. That sort of thing still needs to be, you know, there's got to be some guardrails for making sure moral activity happens or some consequence for those who don't. And so I think of it more in terms of that, I guess, and that there does need to be some restraint for those moments when we all fail to have the right motives and do the right thing. And so I'm trying to think of it more in terms of a restraint, and not just a restraint that the wizard could have moved. He could have plenty of other options to get away from this pot, probably. And it seems to me that, you know, I like much more the idea of it being the voice of a conscience than it really bullying him into anybody. And hopefully the practice of doing good, I mean, where the story ends, you know, we're not sure whether he really changed. But I think as we play with this fairy tale in our minds, we can imagine that over time, the practice of doing good that he has to do because there are certain societal guardrails, in this case, a loud pot, eventually will lead to a recognition of the desirability of doing good and how he's happier in doing good than he was when he was being selfish. And so I try to think it more in those kinds of terms. I don't know if that makes sense.
And that's why I shunted it to you, because I knew you'd have like a compassionate, straight up sort of answer. Whereas I just want to know who wrote this interpretation. Was it Beatrix Bloxham? Was it Dolores Umbridge? I mean, because no, I get it. And ultimately, you want that person to have that moment of, you know, in Greek, it's metanoia, right? That conversion of heart where you come to kind of see the world differently. And maybe see the world the way the divine would see it, you know, instead of just through your own eyes. But, you know, at the same time, I don't know. Now I'm thinking about the story of the prodigal son, right? And you have these two brothers, and everybody always talks about the one brother who runs away and spends his father's inheritance in this dissolute living. But no, you know, very few people reflect on the second brother, and he's really the more interesting figure because he's angry because he's done his father's will And yet his father's not celebrating him the way that he's celebrating the son that was sinful and then came home. But the father turns to him and says something so interesting. He says, son, this is to the second son. He says, son, you are with me always and everything I have is yours. And that has always struck me as the reason that we are to be compassionate to other people, the reason that we are to do, you know, what we know is right, what our conscience is telling us is right, is because it actually makes us happier, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think I would like to think that this wizard did. Yeah, like we said, I'd like to think that he did learn to love helping the Muggles. But I'm also wondering what his story is, like why he didn't receive this inheritance properly the way we usually do from a generous parent. You know, like I like to think that, you know, my parents are very generous people. And I would like to think that I have inherited something of that from their example. Just I kind of couldn't escape it. Like, I'm not sure how I could be. Like, that's why that pot clangs so loudly for me when I am selfish, is because I did inherit this from my parents. And I have a responsibility to act it out, to play it out, you know. But so what's his story? Like, that's what I want to know. I want the fic on this son and how he ended up selfish and mean when his father was so took pains to be so generous. And again, that's a question that kind of relates to this question about George Floyd and the relationship of people of color with the police and the police with people of color. And what can we do to ensure that this inheritance is received in a way that nobody needs a hopping pot? You know, nobody needs these demonstrations. And you know, because we're doing it right from the start. We're doing it right from the beginning. How do we do this? What went wrong? Right. What went wrong with that wizard?
You know, so much of what the wizard does with the hopping pot is really healing people. And it made me think of, you know, the issues of medical care, health care, and the responsibilities that we have to each other. And, you know, I was sort of thinking about mask wearing and the sort of suggestion that regulations requiring that people wear masks in this time of the COVID-19 pandemic are kind of bullying, right? It's taking away people's rights to require this, and that there's this really strong reaction against that, and that the kind of opposing side to that emphasizes that this is how you keep people well. And this has a particular, you know, healing or at least preventative medicine to it.
I think it's a really, really important relevancy, because most of you don't see very many solidly scientific articles saying that mask wearing isn't helping at all, right? It's always framed around, well, the government can't tell me to do that. And that's just so far off the point that that person is not hearing the cries of the sick, right? They're not hearing anything coming out of the pot. All they're able to hear, it seems, is, well, you can't tell me to do that. That's inconvenient for me, which is very much like what this son is. And it's a very strange phenomenon in our society right now where, you know, I just don't tell me what to do. It's often ironically the same crew who, you know, I would do anything for this country and we need to honor those who have given their lives and given everything for this country, but I can't wear a mask, you know, to just keep people safe for a little while. It's a very strange dynamic, which anybody can fall into in any number of ways. It's important, I think, for all of us to not just, I'm mask wearer and I advocate it, despite how uncomfortable I feel like it is. And this is the kind of thing that kind of points us to, you know, where are those places where I'm blind to the suffering of others and I'm being selfish and I'm choosing things that could hurt somebody else. It's certainly a challenge for us in this time of the COVID-19 crisis.
Oh my! And as you were talking, I was thinking, yeah, we could even say that about the kind of cars we choose to drive, or whether we choose to drive at all versus taking public transport or walking or biking or the clothes that we buy, and investigating where they came from and what conditions under which they were made. And, you know, I mean, it's just this whole host of, it's like, as soon as you ask the question in one arena, you're under the obligation to ask it in every arena, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's what this pot really, really symbolizes, is that it's going to contain it all. And it's gonna, I almost wish I had one of these pots, but I'm always like kind of blindsided by things. Ugh. Every few years.
It's called the internet, Emily. I feel like,
yeah, I know.
The internet's constantly showing me all of the and it's like, pain and suffering.
I turn over a rock and I'm just like, whoa, this whole ecosystem I didn't realize was there. And I've mm-hmm. just been so selfish and blind to it. And so I like the pot.
And you see this in stories, you know, you get these occasional news stories of somebody who said, I was against mask wearing or whatever it is. You know, I was against closing down our churches until we all got back together and then somebody got sick and died. And now that I've experienced that suffering, I've changed my mind, right? And we so often wait till it's too late. And the fairy tales and the fantasy, it's there to plead with us. Don't wait till it's too late. You can alleviate this suffering now and not go through it. Don't wait till it's too late.
You hear that from people who have experienced having one of their children come out as LGBTQ plus, right?
Yeah.
And then all of a sudden they've changed their mind about the way that they relate to that community.
Yeah, J.K. Rowling said that this was a story about altruism. And it strikes me that that's really what we've come around to here at the end, the idea that, you know, we're all interconnected. And what we have to realize is that another's pain is our pain. But too often we wait so that the pain is magnified, you know, and I think that's part of what's being illustrated with the hopping pot.
Man, brings me back to Star Wars. May the force of others be with you. It's true. It is, because George, you know, George Lucas said when I'm taking the Signum U Star Wars class this summer, so you got to bear with me here. But he said, you know, when he was coming up with this idea of the Force, you know, he said he studied a lot of world religions, and he said he thinks, you know, and whether you subscribe to this or not, you know, is up to you. But he said he felt that it all boiled down to selfishness versus selflessness, and you can choose to be selfish and self-preserve, and then you kind of you fear everything. So you kind of cover yourself up with all this stuff. And in his Star Wars world, it was, you know, technology, this kind of evil technology like Darth Vader, you know, or you could choose to be selfless and stick your neck out for other people, no matter the consequence. And if you have the bravery, if you have the courage to choose that selfless path, then you will just live a happy life. That's the secret to living a happy life, that you know, like in the story of the prodigal son, you know, you are with me always and everything I have is yours. That's your path, because you chose this selfless life of always serving your father. Right. And so for him, that's the force, you know. He said, this is this force of others, this energy that comes from compassion for all life forms. And if you can tap into that force, nothing can stop you. You can do anything.
Makes me think of, you know, one of the greatest missing things from the Lord of the Rings film series is the scarring of the Shire. And that's the hobbits who stay home and just want to ignore that there is a crisis in the world. The crisis comes to them. And that is such an important thing that of course we all want to live peacefully in the Shire, but sometimes something calls us to something selfless, something bigger. And when you don't answer that call, it's going to come to you one way or another.
Now I'm starting to feel bad for shutting all my window blinds again.
Yeah, like I just think I keep like we were saying, reading this story in this particular moment with COVID-19 and with the outbreaks of violence. And there's a lot of polarization that is becoming expressed in violent ways. And we have to be open to the suffering of others, and we have to try to have a healing spirit toward that. And I think that, you know, we've really pulled that out of this tale that appears on the surface to be simple and also, you know, about a cauldron that belches slugs. And yet it's really, it's got this profound meaning, and I did find it very eye-opening in this moment. And I hope maybe our listeners have benefited from this discussion as well. This was really interesting. I feel like I know
the
more
wizard
now
and the
than
hopping plot.
Yes. I feel like I know more now than I did at the beginning of our conversation, which is that's the best.
Oh, that's always for me. Is that new for you, Kate? I'm just kidding.
No, believe me, I always learn something. Absolutely. Well, thank you so much, Travis Prinzi, for helping us to look deeper into the hopping plot or hopping pot.
Thank you for having me. This was a lot of fun.
We got to have Travis back. This was too fun. This has been a long time coming.
Let's do this again.
Yeah. Yes, for sure.
I get to be on the show every time because I'm singing at the beginning. But...
Yeah.
Oh, that's true. Yep, me too.
I was just going to mention that. Yeah, listeners, this is Travis and Emily together again. You hear them singing on the opening song every time you listen. So thanks, Travis, also for giving us that great music. I always think that's fun. Thanks, Emily, for being my co-host today.
It was especially fun. I needed this today. I really did.
Me too. Yeah. That's, you know, the power of stories is the meaning making and the meaning taking. And I really feel like we were able to do that today at a time when I need some of that. I'd like to give a big thanks to our technical editor in Australia, Emma Nicholson. And as always, we appreciate our partners at MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999, and our MuggleNet producer, Lori Beckoff. Dear listeners, we are also so glad you joined us, and we would love it if you would leave a comment or question for us. Please share your thoughts at readingwritingrolling@gmail.com, readwriteroll on Twitter, or on our Facebook page. I am mixing up our closing quote for these bonus mini-episodes. Due to the unusual crisis we're collectively experiencing due to COVID-19, and now all of the other unrest that we're seeing in our country today. So I'm going to leave you now with some wisdom of Albus Percival Wulfric Brian Dumbledore, who said, "Happiness can be found even in the darkest of times if one only remembers to turn on the light." Please join us next time when we'll be turning on the light with the help of a little Harry Potter magic.